Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
On the broadcast today, Syria and the cost-benefit analysis of what seems sure to be coming over there. The Treasury Department and its bank balance, and gators, alligators. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 27th of August. Glad, as always, to have you with us. The war with Syria starts as early as Thursday. It's going to last 2 or 3 days. Airstrikes probably using cruise missiles almost definitely. I know that sounds cold and matter of fact, but all of the above are quotes from, and here I quote, senior American officials in the press the last day or so. Stephen Cook is a senior fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Stephen, it's good to have you with us.
My pleasure.
First of all, what do you make of these reports that whatever the Obama administration might do, use of force-wise, it will be 2 to 3 days worth versus a military objective defining what's going on?
Well, I think there's two very strong reasons. One is to signal to the American people that the United States is not getting fully involved in another Middle Eastern imbroglio. The second reason is that the Obama administration really doesn't want to get involved in Syria. This is a brutal, terrible civil war with many different factions fighting. And it's clear that the president has put restrictions on the military operations in hopes of not being drawn further into the conflict.
The White House said today, I was just looking at the wires before I came into the studio, they said the president has many options beyond just the use of force. I wonder, do you suppose that means they're still considering sanctions and the like, or is there something else out there?
Well, it sounds more like the administration is buying time on this issue. Now, with this escalation and the use of chemical weapons, there needs to be a signal sent to the international community that the use of these types of weapons are beyond the pale and that there would indeed be consequences as a result of using them.
Do you think whatever military action may or may not be taken by the White House, by the allies, will funding for the Syrian opposition continue? Will it increase now?
Well, to this point, it's mostly been funding from the Gulf countries, the Qataris, the Saudis, the Emiratis. But we may see a more active engagement on the part of Washington's traditional allies in Europe.
That funding for the Free Syrian Army and some of the rebel groups has mostly been, at least as far as I've been able to learn, mostly small arms kinds of things, logistical support. What are the odds that it would extend to anti-aircraft weaponry and things like that?
Well, this has been a source of some controversy because, of course, the United States has had some experience with providing this type of weaponry to rebels before, if you remember back to Afghanistan.
And then having
in the 1980s.
It go very, very bad, you know.
Exactly, yeah. And having it go very, very badly. And this is something, in fact, that the administration has resisted. The problem is, of course, that if one of the goals now of the United States and its allies is to do what it can to level the battlefield, certainly those types of weapons that are effective against helicopters and aircraft would be in order. But, of course, there is always that risk, given that we don't know a lot about different rebel groups in Syria, extremist groups, groups linked to al-Qaeda. There is this great reluctance to supply this type of weaponry.
This is obviously not an equation that will be balanced on dollars and cents. But given fiscal realities in Europe, given fiscal realities here, given the costs of Iraq and Afghanistan, if the next 2 to 3 days are not successful for the Obama administration, what do you suppose the appetite is for prolonged operations?
Well, there's certainly no appetite among the American people. But if, in fact, the first volley, so to speak, does not work, the American people should be prepared for additional rounds of military action until the Pentagon and ultimately the president are satisfied that the goals of the military operation are met.
Stephen Cook, he's a senior fellow in Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Stephen, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure, Kai.
It was a tale of two colors on Wall Street today. Red for stocks, green for oil prices. Geopolitics, or maybe it's just a Tuesday late in August. I don't know. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've got good news and we've got bad news about the state of the nation's finances to share with you. The Treasury Department says it's going to run out of money along about the middle of October unless Congress raises the debt limit. That, obviously, is the bad news. The good news is that we're not exactly going to run out of money. Treasury is still going to have about $50 billion cash on hand. But how can they not know exactly when they're going to run dry? Marketplace's David Weinberg reports.
When we do hit the debt limit, whenever that is, the government won't be able to borrow money, which means that we have to pay all our bills from our bank account.
The federal government primarily banks at the Fed, and then a small amount of money in private bank accounts.
Donald Marin is with the Urban Institute. Now, lots of the bills the government pays from that account are the same amount every month. Paychecks the government employs, Social Security payments.
Then there are other things where just there's uncertainty. We really don't know how many people are going to go see their Medicare doctor this month and what services they're going to get.
There's also unexpected payments to government contractors. We might decide to buy a bunch of cruise missiles to deploy in Syria, for example. And then on the revenue side, there's unexpected payments to the government, like the $60 billion in bailout money that Fannie Mae recently paid back.
And about $20 billion in a special dividend from Freddie Mac, which were not in the baseline forecast.
Steve Bell is the former staff director of the Senate Budget Committee. He says there's so much uncertainty in the budget that the debt can go up or down by billions of dollars on a daily basis.
So there's some days when you have $3 billion more that day that came in than you expected, and some days when you have $3 billion less.
And then there's just the sheer scale of the accounting. Every day, the U.S. Treasury processes 10 million transactions. That's 10 million factors that affect the Treasury Department's prediction as to when we hit the debt ceiling. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Not unrelated to the debt limit comes this item. American consumers continue to feel good about the economy. The Consumer Confidence Index, out today from a private research firm called the Conference Board, was as high as it's been in about 5 years. Kate Davidson explains why that might be.
It may seem funny to assign a number to consumer confidence. It's part how people feel about the economy now and part how they expect the economy to be in coming months. Put it all together, and the Conference Board's Lynn Franco says this month's number is 81.5. That's better, but
generally when they're extremely confident, we get readings of 90 or above. So, you know, we're sort of on the right path, but we still have a ways to go.
Economists say the tailwinds on that path are that the job market is slowly improving, stock prices are up, housing prices are rising. But the headwinds, says PNC economist Gus Fauché, are that
wage growth is very weak. The unemployment rate, although it's coming down, is still at 7.4%. And overall, employment's down by about 2 million from where it was prior to the recession. So those are drags on confidence.
One thing about this month's measure of consumer confidence is that the expectations part of it went up. People were more optimistic. Chris Christopher is an economist with IHS Global Insight. He says that's in part because the recovery has been so anemic. It only takes a little bit of good news to boost consumers' confidence.
So what would make them happy now takes a lot less on the economic front than it would, let's say, in 2005, you know, when things are doing very well.
Economists say consumer confidence is important because it's an early predictor of trends in the economy. In this case, a modestly upward trend. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
Much like fads in fashion or music or television, economic indicators, too, come into and go out of style. One that was hot a couple of years ago and has cooled just a tad since then is something called the Baltic Dry Index. It has, in the past year or so, been going great guns, as are prices for some of the commodities that it tracks. Sarah McCammon takes a look now at what that says about the state of the global economy.
If you think the Baltic Dry Index sounds a little dry, then you're not Jeffrey Landsberg.
There's always a lot going on with dry balls, you know, which is why I love it.
Spoken like a true analyst. Landsberg is president of Commodore Research and Consultancy.
It follows so many different commodities.
Like grain, coal, and especially iron ore, most of it going to China's steel industry. The index is up more than 60% from a year ago, with much of that growth in the past couple of months. David Beard is the managing director of shipping research at Iberia Capital Partners.
In a period of time where most people would say, well, we're in a global economic malaise or we're worried about China, the exports of iron ore into China from both Brazil and Australia have been very strong.
It's a tentative positive sign.
Walter Kimsey's is chief economist with the engineering firm Moffitt & Nickel. He says the index doesn't tell the whole story. For example, a lot of orders for a few big ships can drive up the numbers, even as smaller ships are sitting idle. And there's another big factor that the Baltic Dry Index doesn't take into account: oil tankers. David Beard says companies in that line of work are struggling.
And I don't think it's down because the global economies are weak, although that's part of it. It's really down because the U.S. is importing less oil.
We're getting it closer to home from Canada and the upper Midwest. I'm Sarah McCammon for Marketplace.
We've been asking over the past week, maybe 10 days or so, for stories of first jobs. Today, a first job from a different time.
My name is Carla Erdman. I live in Green Bay, Wisconsin now. And at the age of 70, I did just retire from my career in the health insurance industry. I was 16 when I got my first job, and that was in 1959. It was in a small neighborhood grocery store on Bartlett Street in the east side of Milwaukee. I made probably, I'm thinking, 35 or 40 cents an hour. The new job gave me a sense of accomplishment, not to mention the fact that I was probably in my mind already spending the money before I got my first paycheck. One day, as the store was closed up and I walked the three or four blocks back to my house, I realized that my boss was in the car heading toward my house as well. When he came to our door, he said he needed to speak with my mother. He and my mom sat down on the sofa, and I kind of hovered around and listened to them. And he said, you know, as a small grocer, I rely on the goodwill of the customers in the neighborhood to make my living. And since I have hired Carla, in the last 3 days, I've gotten several phone calls from neighbors who are telling me that they are going to take their business down the street if I keep her on. And the reason that he was saying to my mother that he was going to have to let me go was because my older sister, 19 at the time, had a black boyfriend. And when it finally sunk in, and then he literally, with hat in hand, said goodbye and left, I cried. I did not ever despise this man or resent him. Let's face it, he was trying to run a business and feed his family just like my mother was. So I guess I learned that hard business decisions have to be made, and the employers have to make those hard decisions and live with them, and employees have to, all I can think of is roll with it and do the best you can and keep trying.
Carla Erdman is a listener from Wisconsin. We're still collecting first job stories. Share yours with us, letters at marketplace.org. Coming up, the promise of the I Have a Dream speech today.
That sounds great, but in reality, we're still dreaming.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials tumbled 170 points today, 1.1%, 14,776 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ off 79 points, about 2.1%, ended things at 3,578. The S&P 500 dipped 26 points, 1.5%, 1630 there. Airline stocks took a hit on fears of higher fuel costs. United Continental dipped down almost 7.25%. Delta Airlines cruised almost 5.75% lower. Southwest turned down 3.5% today. Crude oil, as we were speaking about, closed at $108.91 in New York today. That is up 2.8%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note dropped to 2.71%, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Wednesday. The National Association of Realtors issues its monthly pending home sales index. It looks at contract activity in July. Maybe you bought that house and you're already planning Thanksgiving dinner. Need a gravy boat? Williams-Sonoma releases quarterly earnings. And why not have that leftover turkey sandwich now? August is National Sandwich Month. Light mayo, whole wheat, whole the cranberries, please. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Even before the earthquake back in 2010, Haiti was no easy place. Hardships and poverty, instability and violence are a long part of its history. You throw in some wrenching family reality, and that's a good part of the plot of Edwige Dantica's new novel. It's called Claire of the Sea Light. Edwige, good to speak with you.
Good to speak with you.
This is a story that has so many characters in it. And if you read the reviews and if you listen to other interviews you've done, people talk about the people, and the sea is a big character in this book. I wonder, though, what you think of this proposition that that poverty and aspiration and wanting something better is also a character in this book.
Absolutely. You're the first person who said it, but I think it's absolutely right on track. This idea of wanting better for oneself, wanting better for one's child, in an environment where the actual environment, the political environment, the financial opportunities are villains, if you will, obstacles in your way. So absolutely, dreaming, aspiring, working hard, all of these are part of the fabric of this book.
To get to the plot just a little bit, because obviously I don't want to give it away, but Claire, of the title, Claire of the Sea Light, is given away by her father in hopes of a better life. I mean, that's the crux of this book.
Her father, like a lot of parents in this type of difficult situation, has to make a very horrible choice, a sort of Faustian bargain, whether he wants to keep her with him or whether he wants to let her live with somebody else who can give her a better future. And in the book, the father, thinking about market, thinking about money, writes a letter to Claire saying, you know, I'm not selling you, because he realizes that there are situations in which people do sell their children.
That's really interesting, actually. And we should say just parenthetically that Claire's mother dies in childbirth, which is why, you know, the father's having a tough time. But that idea that it's not a transaction, that there's not a price to this little girl is revelatory in a little bit of a way.
Well, because to him, it's important for his daughter to know that this is not just another situation where people have been sold, because we also, our society, Haiti, our societies that were initially formed out of a very terrible transaction, the horrible slave trade, you know, the sale of human beings is so deep a part of our history that, you know, whenever elements of it emerge in our day-to-day transactions, it's something that is that's painful and uncomfortable, even in the present.
You talk about the city, the town, actually, that this book takes place in, Villerose, as a town that is 5% wealthy, which, of course, harkens to this thing we had 3 or 4 years ago here of the 99% at Occupy and the 1%. Do you ever look at what happens in America and say, you guys have no idea what you're talking about?
Well, I mean, I think that would be the simple way to do it, right? Because
well, I'm so glad I pointed it out then. Yeah.
I live in America, because if I say it simple, I'm talking to myself also. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the things that is always worth remembering is that there are cities in America where you could find very parallel situations to places in the developing world, the super rich people, the way that wealth is distributed. And there are also parallels in poverty.
Edwige Dantica's latest book, it's a novel, is called Claire of the Sea Light. Edwige, thanks a lot. Good to talk to you.
Thank you. And thank you for talking about a novel on Marketplace.
I know, right? Go figure that one out. Take care.
Thank you.
Alligator season opens tomorrow down in Louisiana. Hunters will be casting some really big hooks, I guess, out in the wetlands, if they're lucky enough to get a permit in the state gator lottery. The one-month open season is big business down there, gang. Think Hermes and Gucci. Go ahead, think about it for a second. From Red River Radio, Kate Archer-Kent reports.
Tony Howard is a nuisance alligator hunter. He legally hunts alligators year-round. He steps inside the walk-in cooler behind his house in rural Sarepta, Louisiana. There in the corner is a mound of neatly coiled and cured alligator skins, ready for market.
Whole alligators are kept in here until they are processed. This keeps them at a constant temperature, low, and so it gives me more time to skin them.
Howard runs a processing business on the side. He'll skin dozens of alligators this season and then sell the hides at the best price. He says the cost of a whole alligator could jump 10% over last year. A 10-footer might fetch about $400.
We're not out to make a killing. We're not out to retire off of it. It's just a commodity, and you have to shop it and try to get the best price you can out of the commodity.
Howard says that's attracted more alligator buyers to the market. About 34,000 wild alligators will be harvested from Louisiana this year. Meanwhile, luxury goods companies are buying alligator and crocodile farms and tanneries around the world. They want more control over their raw material. Christy Plott Red is vice president of sales at American Tanning and Leather in Griffin, Georgia. She says this is good for business.
Luxury brands that buy tanneries typically use alligator and crocodile every season, year after year, and it lends stability to our industry and also increases demand for the skins.
And demand is strong, so Red is trying to get an edge over other buyers. Her tannery is awarding $10,000 to the fisherman who brings her the biggest catch and all their alligators for this season, regardless of what they look like.
Like grading diamonds, you have good ones and you have bad ones.
Red's tannery will eat the cost on ones that aren't perfect enough for her customers, the fashion houses.
Maybe less than 10% of the alligators that we buy are really first-grade skins. You sell those at a premium price. But the ones that are bad, they stack up on your shelves for years and years.
A typical handbag may take two or three alligators. European craftsmanship drives up the price. There's also a thriving secondary market for collectors of alligator handbags, according to Thomai Sardari, who teaches luxury marketing at NYU's Stern School of Business.
There is a constant exchange in a very small group of people who tend to actually increase the prices. And we have bags, alligator bags that have hit the market that go as high as $130,000, which is absurd.
Sardari says soaring prices are driven by a strong demand from luxury consumers in Asia. But in Bayou country, gator hunter Tony Howard just hopes that temperatures remain summer-like so the big ones bite and the season isn't a bust.
The only time that I enjoy is whenever I'm leaving the bar with check in hand. The rest of it's all, it's a job.
His part is not glamorous, but it pays the bills. In Sarepta, Louisiana, I'm Kate Archer-Kent for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, President Obama is going to honor Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech with a speech of his own. Donald Cash was at the March on Washington 50 years ago. He was working in the warehouse of a women's clothing store back then. Today, he's a labor leader with the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, and he was back in the Capitol this past weekend to mark the anniversary of that march, along with his son, also a labor organizer, and his grandson. So we asked all three generations of Cashes to talk about economic opportunity 50 years on.
My name is Donald Cash, Sr., and I'm 68 years old, blessed.
I'm Donald Cash II, and I'm 43.
My name is Donald Cash III, and my age is 8.
I was 18 years old 50 years ago. I believe at that time my wages were about $1.15 an hour. Even in those days, it was very little money. It was minimum wage. Matter of fact, I remember that I was trying to save everything that I could. I used to walk to 14th and Columbia Road. It's about 20-plus blocks just to save the bus fare.
What's your reaction on that?
The dollar thing is bad, but the 10 blocks, you can run to there, get some exercise while you're doing it.
I went to the unemployment office and applied for an apprenticeship. The only jobs that you could have in the grocery store at that time in 1965 was put groceries in the back of the car, and the other one was to, whenever anything broke on the floor, they called to clean up the floor, and that was classified as a porter. That was the time that no blacks cutting meat for chain stores in the city was unheard of. Anyway, the gentleman from the government came in and said, Giant's beginning to hire meat cutters. Would you be interested? And Giant offered me a job cutting meat as an apprentice for $95 a week. All of my benefits was paid, dental care, vision care. And I was very proud then because I knew I had a trade. 5 years later, I became the first black organizer for, at that time, it was the Amalgamated Meat Cutters and Butcher Workmen of North America Union. When I was able to buy a house in 1973, I remember the feeling that I had when I bought my first house. It was the American dream. I thought I had made it.
Always through the years was helping my dad. It was really educating me that I had to finish school, but also not only finish school, but serve to try to do my part and to try to help people. What I hope for my kids as they grow older is to understand that they were fortunate, but two, to get a good education. What you like about school and what's your favorite subject?
What I like about school is I get to see my friends.
Okay.
And my favorite subject is math and science. When I grow up, I want to be a basketball player.
So if you're not a basketball player, what do you want to do? Because you have to have a fallback plan.
I like to play football, but I don't want to get injured.
Yeah, but...
What do you like about science?
You get to do fun stuff at school when you do science.
That's what Dr. Martin Luther King dreamed of, you know, everybody being equal and race not being an issue. And that sounds great, but in reality, we're still dreaming. And I think that, yes, there has been progress, but there's a long way to go.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, which comes to us from the pages of this morning's Columbus Dispatch out of Columbus, Ohio. Ohio State University has sold the naming rights to the new emergency department at its medical school. The OSU Board of Trustees will vote Friday to create the Abercrombie & Fitch Emergency Department. The ANFER will join the Abercrombie & Fitch Chair in Inflammatory Bowel Disease, which was set up last year. ANF, should you be curious, is based in New Albany, Ohio. That is just outside Columbus. We are based in Los Angeles. That's Marketplace from APM. Thanks to Meg Kramer, Justin Ho, and Katie Long on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report interim producer is Sean Bowditch. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back. And this is APM.